The Roaring Twenties, Part 6, Miss America and King Tut. Now, it is fitting that in an era hell-bent on public competitions as a means of gaining individual notoriety, the Miss America contest was created in Atlantic City in 1921. Conceived by the town fathers and the local newspapermen, its goal was not only to catapult a milk-fed Miss Nobody into an overnight celebrity, but to promote the seaside resort, specifically to extend the tourist season beyond the traditional Labor Day cutoff, well into September. And it did keep hotels booked for additional weeks. This premier pop culture beauty contest, though, has come a long way from the days of its first winner, 16-year-old Margaret Gorman, 30, 25, 32. To say the success of a Phyllis George, 36, 24, 36. Today, the televised contest is an annual phenomenon, commanding the attention of nearly half of Saturday night viewers. But the first competition was a modest affair that featured only 8 women, with most of the public attention centered on the pre-Brett Parks host called King Neptune, who is actually Hudson Maxim, of the armaments-inventing Maxim family. Contestants then represented cities, not states, and qualified by winning a hometown popularity contest. Once in Atlantic City, they participated in a bathing review, for which even the all-male orchestra donned swimsuits. The hedonism of the 20s made the contest possible and contributed to its rapidly expanding success, as well as criticism. In 1922, its second year, 57 cities sent young hopefuls, which the Atlantic City Daily Press boldly described as jazz babies who shook the meanest kind of shoulders, pink-skinned beauties of all type. The roller chair parade down the famed boardwalk, reported the press, showed off tanned athletic girls, bare limbs, and shapely figures, bejeweled favorites of the harem, stately colonial dames in hoop skirts with black eyes peeping coyly from behind waving fans. Several girls flaunted the coming vogue of the bobbed hair, which was considered by the judges too radical. A judge that year was the artist Norman Rockwell. Evening gowns competition was then added in 1924. In the 20s, the contest already served as a vehicle for the new celebrity-creating mill that was moving pictures. A motion picture ball was held on the Steel Pier in 1922, where film tests were made of each contestant in search for a girl who clicked in the pictures. Despite the decade's hedonism, the Miss American contest aroused widespread criticism from several quarters. The Trenton, New Jersey YWCA worried about the grave dangers from unscrupulous persons to which the girls were exposed. Before the competition, a spokesperson said the girls were splendid examples of innocent and pure womanhood. Afterwards, their heads were filled with vicious ideas such as money, career, and self. The New York Times damned the contest as a reprehensible way to advertise Atlantic City. Now, the first few winners turned out to be, excuse the bluntness, airheads. Contest officials sought out a different type of entrant. This year's contest will be a higher plane than ever, promised the Daily Press in 1925, and its participants will represent pastors, daughters, school teachers, college girls, and femininity generally of the most desirable type. When criticism of the titillating aspects of the bathing suit competition refused to be silenced, that review was actually dropped, as was the Miss America contest itself in 1927. The problem was simple. The kind of girl entering the contest was not yet a noble representative of American womanhood, but most often was, in the slang phrase of the day, a dumb Dora. Indeed, when the contest was resumed in 1935, promoters attempted to skirt the criticism by instituting a talent competition to convince the public each girl had more than just body beauty. In the past, read an official press release, good looks usually suffice to win both the coveted trophy and perhaps a stage and screen career. This time, there will be no beautiful but dumb Dora. The caliber girl was more upscale, that is, she had more education. The next year, 1936, the Atlantic City mayor, Charles White, opened the pageant with the reminder, "We are past the time when beauty parades are in the nature of floor shows." This was a cultural event seeking a high type of beauty. While the 20s idealized the free-spirited flapper and spawned such liberties as couples dance marathons, it wanted its representative Miss neither to sport bobbed hair nor to dance the Charleston. Now, all the way at the opposite end of the spectrum for the 20s, we have the King Tut mania. Scarab rings, Tut nickel cigars, turquoise Tut bracelets and hieroglyphics printed on dresses and handbags, dining chairs in the upright style of Egyptian thrones, and American newborns across the land named Tutter, a boy, and Tuti, a girl, after, of course, the Egyptian pharaoh King Tutankhamun. These are a sampling of the first wave of Tut mania that swept America in 1923 until the stock market crash. The fad enjoyed an enormous revival in the 1970s, sparked then by the exhibition of King Tut's treasures at major museums. The initial fad, fanned by extraordinary newspaper coverage, owed to the discovery of in 1922 of the 18-year-old pharaoh's intact burial chamber by English Egyptologist Howard Carter. The public quickly learned that inside the tomb, the boy king laid in a nest of three coffins, the innermost solid gold, the outer two gold hammered over wooden frames. On King Tut's head was a golden portrait mask, and priceless pieces of jewelry and amulets adorned the mummy and its wrappings. The coffins were surrounded by four shrines of hammered gold, while other rooms were crammed with furniture, statues, clothes, a chariot, and weapons. In life, Tut, who reigned from 1361 to 1352 BCE, had little claim to fame, having died in his teens. But through the treasure trove in his tomb, he became the most famous of Egypt's male rulers, with, to use a modern measure of celebrity, a Q rating perhaps equal to Cleopatra's. His name was on the lips of millions of Americans. Many have probably lived through, if not participated in, the Tut tumult of the 70s, as some 55 priceless tomb treasures toured the country. More than 400 manufacturers rushed to create and cash in on the pharaoh fad, marketing Tut coffee mugs, wallpaper, needlepoint pillows, and solid gold artifacts. There was even a Tut spoof song interpreted with the funky Egyptian mannerisms by comedian Steve Martin. Department stores like Bloomingdale's and Macy's devoted aisles and cosmetic counters to Tut paraphernalia, which included exotic, Koei-like eye paint. But the 70s madness was nothing compared to the first wave of Tut mania. Tut was the longest-running single fad of the 1920s and was only calmed down by the stock market crash. But why the endurance? Sociologists point to the intellectual overtones of a fad based on a scientifically significant archaeological find. The average person, by owning even the most kitsch Tut artifact, became associated with and participated in one of the major unearthings of the century. And to be able to talk socially about the tomb and its boy king, Egyptology nonetheless, carried a cachet not applicable to conversation, say, fads of frisbees, hula hoops, and the like. In the 20s, a long-dead Egyptian king was as well-known to Americans as such heavyweights as Babe Ruth and Jack Dempsey. Tut was the top, according to Cole Porter. Now, the source for this, Panotti's Parade of Fads, Follies, and Manias, The Origins of Our Most Cherished Possessions, by Charles Panotti. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.